Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to the Fides Club. This is the show where we get people from around the world to tell you how they saw the news from the past month. This is show number 32 for January 2011. Hello everyone and welcome to the Fides Club. Thank you very much to my co-hosts for not laughing at that very elegant January that I just said. My co-hosts were laughing earlier and it's understandable because they're all very funny. Scott Johnson is with us as well.
Hey Patrick, I have, by the way, a cough switch. So when I laugh, I hold that down.
That is very kind of you. Charles is also there, and as usual, Turkey is joining us as well. Scott is
and
from
Turkey is here from the Middle East, where we have a great 2011.
It starts well. We're going to be talking about this. Just before that, though, I want to make sure that our listeners know where everyone is from. Scott, of course, has been on the show before, and he has a few others. So everyone will know that he is from Utah. Very proud of it, too.
Yeah. Yeah. The beautiful west desert of Utah.
Excellent. Charles, however, is new to the show, and he is staying up extremely late watching football to be with us, which we are very thankful for. Are you in Sydney, Charles?
No, I'm in Melbourne. I'm in Melbourne.
Okay.
Melbourne's sort of been characterized for me as the kind of place where it's more impressive if you're a barista than you are a barrister. That's something that defines Melbourne quite well. Cafe culture is king here.
I don't know what a barista is, but I think it's funny that it sounds like the other word you said.
Dear Lord, you don't know what a barista is?
No, I don't. Please
enlighten me. Oh, mate, the person that makes coffee.
What is it?
A person that makes coffee.
Oh, okay. So, see, I don't like coffee.
It's an Italian word for a coffee, mate. Good. You call yourself European, I don't know.
What time is it for you now?
20 to 4 in the morning.
Oh, Jesus. My gosh.
All right. And it is also, some might not realize, the middle of summer for you.
Yep, we're looking forward to 40 degrees tomorrow down in Melbourne, so just
that's
another summer's day.
40 degrees Celsius for you dirty...
Is it? Yes, I have to deal with the international difference, that's right.
All right, thanks so much for being here and for staying up this late for us. Turkey is also, you also know him, of course. He is from Saudi Arabia, and he's with us every single episode, so it won't be a surprise. All right, Turkey.
Show the love, Patrick. Show the love.
I'm showing the love to everyone. Are you feeling, Turkey, are you feeling not enough love coming from me? Is that what you're trying to say?
No, I'm not feeling it, Patrick. I'm really sad at the moment.
Okay, well, you know what? I'm going to be extremely demonstrative with you now, because I'm going to take your part of the world and make it the main topic of the show today. Ooh, before I do that, though, I want to thank the chat room that assembled in record time, because we're actually streaming with multiple video streams from all around the world, thanks to the new video version feature of Skype. So thanks to the chat room for being here. I hope you enjoy the show. First topic that I want to mention, which is, to be completely honest, the main topic that has occupied our news cycles here in France, is, of course, the Middle East and what has happened in Tunisia and what is happening as we speak in Egypt. Just so if in case people have not listened to the previous show, we had sort of a debate, I guess, earlier this month in very early January about the fact that what was happening in Tunisia was making the news for us in France every single day, and it was enormously presented as enormously important. And Turkey made the very good point that I was, when I was saying that I was surprised it wasn't being reported as much in the other parts of the world, Turkey made the point that this was really news mainly coming from older French colonies. And that was maybe why we were getting more of it here in France. And then,
you see, Patrick, French colonies, ex-French colonies are not very popular. Now, Egypt, an ex-British colony, apparently everybody knows about it.
Well, you know, it's so there are really two parts of the main parts of the story here. The first one is Tunisia, and then there's Egypt. But if we focus on Tunisia for just a second, when we last spoke, I was saying that I didn't really see how, and I think we sort of were agreeing on this, Turkey, we didn't really see how things could evolve into a full, complete revolution. And then the next day we woke up and all of a sudden it was a full, complete revolution. Because what I was saying was that it would turn into a conflict. If it was to be a revolution, it would turn into a conflict and it would have to become bloody. And for some reason, without any real logic to it. Well, there was, of course, a lot of logic, but it didn't follow our reasoning, which means obviously it wasn't logical. I went to bed one day and then I woke up and all of a sudden Ben Ali had left power. It didn't seem like there was enough pressure for him to just leave without even trying to fight it, but apparently there was, because he just left and Tunisia just became a successful revolution. I'm sort of blabbering on here.
From what I heard from the news, Patrick, that he was tricked out of the country.
That's interesting. Apparently
his head of security convinced him that he needs to leave, and the head of security was planning to take over control.
Okay.
That's why, if you follow the news, he never resigned officially.
Right.
Because he was planning to come back.
He can't have been that silly that he was like, oh, I'm going to leave and then I'm going to come back in a minute, in a couple of weeks.
Well, everything's
going
to
be fine.
The head of his security said, you need to leave for a few days until we get things done, set up.
Okay.
And then he was overthrown by that constitution 2 days later.
Yeah, I guess we didn't really hear about that. That aspect of it, but it's I guess that's how it's happened, because I don't really see why he would leave anyway. But if the muscle tells him, just be safe and we'll make it, we'll take care of it, boss, and then all of a sudden he's not the boss anymore. But I'm very curious though to hear from Scott and Charles, because first of all, from Scott, because what we heard on the previous episode was that this didn't really even make the news. I'm guessing that when he actually left and the thing started propagating, then it did make the news, and more than a little.
Well, one of the things I always have to sort of take into account for my news consumption is that I dumped cable and satellite about 3 years ago, and I get everything I get online. So I get a much broader take. I get a lot more coverage than I would have with, two or three 24-hour news stations with their own slant or their own coverage. And so in my case, I saw a ton of the Tunisia stuff, and we're seeing a ton of what's happening in Egypt. But I think on the whole,
Even before Ben Ali left?
Yeah, oh yeah. This this came up pretty quick, and it, of course it was all over Twitter. But again, that's me getting my news from this, a lot of the same sources you do. But as far as what like the mainstream media over here covered, I can't speak to that too much except to say Egypt is getting a lot more coverage than right. it did. Whether Tunisia got a fair shake in terms of total coverage, I can't really say. But I can say, having seen a couple of things here in the last couple of days, on regular old, good old fashioned non-internet TV, Egypt is a huge topic of on the lips of every major network and every station. So I don't know what the difference is. I don't know why that makes more news. Is Tunisia just less of a more of a blip on people's maps, and Egypt is a bigger deal? I don't know, but the general consensus I seem to see, and I feel this too, is I'm curious about how this is, these kinds of revoltings are perceived in the region as a whole. Does it feel like a trend toward toppling 30-year-old governments and starting over? Is it a trend toward democracy? Is it a trend away from democracy? Like, that stuff isn't being discussed, and I'm super curious about it. I don't even know if Turkey can speak to that or not, or whether, you know, from his perspective, but it feels like change is in the air anyway.
Yeah, we can get into the broader discussion just in a few minutes. I just want to finish the round table round. And go to Charles, because first of all, he's very far away physically from all these concerns, but you know, I'm sure obviously they've been discussed. But you also have
I think Charles has a bigger concern at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. You have a whole other world of trouble in your area of the world. So what was your view of all of this?
So quite similar to what Scott said, the events in Tunisia have sort of blipped on the popular media, but what we're seeing in Egypt is significantly more extensively covered. In fact, to be perfectly honest, I only know about Tunisia as a result of Egypt. I was not directly aware of a lot of trouble in Tunisia until the Egypt report started coming through and telling us that they were inspired by the events in Tunisia. That could be my slight media blackout that happens from time to time and not paying close attention to what's going on in the news every now and then. But you wouldn't have been able to stay away from what's happening in Egypt, whether you were paying close attention to the news or not, and that's starkly contrasted with the events in Tunisia. I'm very interested in getting onto the more detailed discussion in a short while. I think a couple of Scott's points, I'd take a little bit further in a slightly different direction as well. So looking forward to that chat.
Yeah, that's definitely more consistent with what we heard last month. But let's move on to Egypt, and it I have to be completely honest, it also feels like, with Egypt getting into the same movement, that is when it completely exploded, because we sort of felt like it might spread to Algeria or something like that, more of the Northern African, Western Northern African countries. But this thing in Egypt is kind of, that's not where we saw it, we thought it was going to go. And it does bring... It does raise a lot of hope in general for the movement, the general movement that it is getting into. But it also raises concerns, and we can talk about these concerns a little bit later. But by the way, I have to ask Turkey, we didn't even mention this, but Ben Ali, when he left Tunisia, he went to Saudi Arabia. I'm not sure he's still there. From what we know, he hasn't left. How was that perceived, like how was it reported on? How was it perceived in Saudi Arabia, and the fact that he went there?
Well, he is still here, and official media did not report much about it, other than that the king has welcomed him and gave him a haven. Mm. And in the public opinion, the majority are pissed off that they gave him haven in Saudi. However, the problem is it comes down to our culture. In the Saudi culture and Bedouin culture specifically, if someone comes to you and asks for your protection, you really have no option but to accept giving him protection. If you turn him back, then that's a complete insult and a shameful thing to do. And of course, Saudi Arabia did give him asylum. However, there was a condition, which is they usually give to anybody who asks for asylum, complete blackout from media and complete blackout from any political activities.
So what's the what do you do long term when that happens? Does he stay there forever? Does he eventually, you know, say, "Ah, I'm moving to Maryland"? Yeah.
Well, it's, as long as he doesn't speak about it, doesn't interfere in politics or talks to the media, he can stay as long as he wants. As soon as he starts interfering with politics or media, then he's kicked out.
So he would actually be kicked out, you think, if he started campaigning for, you know, expressing his opinion or anything?
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, okay. Yeah, because that would be against the conditions of his asylum.
Okay, so the people is not welcoming him in any way. It's just, okay, we have to do it, but, you know, just keep your mouth shut.
Yeah, most people are really pissed off that day. We welcomed him, but our culture, our traditions did not give us a choice in this. And I believe that was the right thing. I really don't, in my own belief system, it's our culture. And I do believe that if someone comes to ask for your protection, you have to protect him.
Okay, I see. The other thing that is remarkable about both of these movements is how, of course, we're a podcast on the internet. We have to mention the fact that it is completely fueled by the internet and social networks. And the fact that is really a leaderless revolution. At least it was in Tunisia. It's starting to become a little bit different in Egypt, but it's really fueled and powered by the internet. Certainly, it wouldn't be completely non-existent if there was no internet, but still, it's really the internet is what makes it possible, and specifically Facebook and Twitter. So much so that the government in Egypt completely cut people off the internet, completely cut off the internet a few days ago. They had to bring it back more or less because the country just stops if they don't have connection to the outside. But any thoughts on this? Or
yeah, we had a weird in the States, we had a weird kind of follow up to that. And that was kind of a bit of outrage over a senator's comment. Senator Joseph Lieberman, former presidential candidate and Democratic Party Senate dude, Joseph Lieberman. The one that Jon Stewart always says sounds like Droopy, for those out there who may not know who that is. Anyway,
he looks like too.
Yeah, he looks just like him and sounds like him. But He came out essentially, or some stuff was revealed where he wants to do the same thing. He wants the U.S. to have the ability in time of crisis or something to be able to literally flip a switch and turn the entire internet off, in his words. And people flipped out. That is absolutely an unacceptable form of anything in this country, according to most people, according to our culture, and that would be really, really bad. So he's taking all kinds of heat today for stating such a thing. He thinks it's, you know, people think it's ridiculous. He likes the fact that, you know, the government would have a way to sort of control that and stop the flow of information, which just seems contrary to everything else we claim to think or believe about the flow of information. So that was an interesting twist on that.
Which is also, oh, sorry, someone else was going to. No. Okay.
I don't think so.
Which is also brings us to the government's voices in general in this. I'm sort of following a plan of talking about every aspect of this, and you'll see where I'm going in the end. The governments have not been extremely vocal. It's specifically in the case of Tunisia and even in Egypt.
Unbelievable.
Ooh, something happened. But they haven't been very vocal in their support to the people, and a lot of people have been critical of this. at least in France and Tunisia, the government was very timid. And in, even in Egypt, in the case of Egypt now, the government has issued a document that, you know, says the government of Egypt should be careful with what they do and not resort to violence and things like that. But they have not come out in support specifically of the people. And that is a little bit, I don't know. What did you guys get the same kind of reaction? I mean, very clearly in France, we're getting a good job from the media in general saying their government, you know, is not being very straightforward with this and sort of hesitant.
Are you talking about the French government or the Egyptian government?
Well, I'm saying that other governments in general have not come out and said what's happening in Egypt is super duper cool and let's support the people in their revolution as much as we can. Because if you think about it, basically, the biggest, I'm going to be a little bit of a devil's advocate here. The biggest critical aspect of what President Bush was doing when he invaded Iraq was you can't just sprinkle, you know, pixie freedom dust on the country. It has to come from the people. And when that happens, then yes, there can be a real revolution kind of thing. But if you just go in and tell people you want democracy, then it's not going to work. And now,
Patrick, do you know what's the biggest opposition party in Egypt?
I'm sorry?
Do you know which is the biggest opposition party in Egypt?
Yes, and we'll get to that in a minute, and we need to say that.
Yeah, but I think that's what answers your question.
No, absolutely, I agree. Oh, by the way, this is becoming very relevant. I'm going to see if Omri, who has joined us in the past, who is in Israel, can join us in this conversation also. Let's try and invite him. He sent me a message. He was following us live. Let's see if he can join us. He might be surprised that I'm inviting him without prior notice. But
Omri, who has joined us in the past.
Oh, well, he is he's listening to the show live. So there you go. Omri, can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, excellent.
Me and my son can hear you.
Can you come a little bit closer to the mic, please? Because we're hearing you.
Yes, I'm here.
Quiet. Cool. all right. So the thing you were hinting at, I imagine, Turkey, was absolutely something that is a concern, I think, to most of us. Well, not most of us, definitely to the governments, and maybe why they are a little bit hesitant to come out in support of the revolutions, which is in all these countries, and specifically in Egypt, if the power of the dictatorship falls, then there is a very strong concern that the power will shift to, can we say Muslim extremists, or is it just radicals, or how can we say it exactly?
Well, let's just
the Muslim
call them
Brotherhood
as they call
is
themselves, the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yes. Okay. So the name, I guess, is the Muslim Brotherhood, and that's clear enough. Is that a legitimate concern for the governments to have, or is it just, you know, fear mongering? Or I'm sure, you know.
Well, especially if you're thinking like about the U.S., it's definitely a major concern since it's going to affect the relationship between Egypt and Israel.
Yeah, absolutely. But, well, let's say, okay, before we even get into that, the reason for the tepid support was if these dictatorships, as dictatorship-like that they were, were sort of having a very strong hand on these parties. And that's the reason why maybe the Western government were not as eager to announce that they weren't supporting them anymore, which I'm a little bit all over the place here. But it makes it sort of very understandable that people like the, you know, Barack Obama or people in France, the government in France, would not want to just throw away the dictatorship, because it does leave a vacuum that will call for more radical views, and especially Muslim extremists.
That's kind of the theory over here, that the why Obama has been less than outspoken about it, because in the past, you know, people have been, the presidents have often just stood right up and said, we stand with the people of Whatcha, and say, you know, good job on whatever the heck it is you're doing. And this time it's been a little more subdued, although there has been, you know, we stand with the people. We're trying to be, you know, help wherever we can, humanitarian, this and that. But it hasn't been a stark sort of, yes, let's take down that government, because they're not sure what will be there in its place. And, you know, Egypt's a strategic partner with our country. We see them as an ally with a rocky past and an interesting past and a very volatile sort of, you know, relationship now. So to have all of that get kind of torn apart and nobody quite knows where all the dust lands when you're done, you know, they're not going to come out and say one. They're not going to come out in full support of the government either. They're going to come out and sort of be ambiguous and let it play out a little bit and see what it's like on the ground. And, you know, we've been vocal about information flow. That's one thing that a lot of politicians, except for Lieberman, have been calling for is more transparency on what's going on there. And, you know, I was really glad to see. Oh, I just forgot the name of the stupid network. But anyway, Al Jazeera had really the only stream that you could get your hands on the last couple of days, and to see what was actually happening on the streets. And I think we hate the fact that's the only way to get info. Like, we want to have free and open conversation. People should be able to Twitter the hell out of the place. They should be able to do whatever they want. And that bugs people. But they're not going to come out and go, bad government or good people. They're going to come out and go, let's see how this plays out, which makes him look kind of goofy too. I agree. I don't like the fact that we're kind of trying to balance between those two extremes.
Patrick, I sure just noticed totally apparently, I don't know how when this happened, but apparently Mubarak just swore in a deputy president, vice president.
Yeah, which happened a couple of hours ago.
Yeah, and that hasn't been, there hasn't been a vice president for 30 years.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So I think that's one step of him trying to tell people, my son is not going to be the next president.
Sure, but it does seem like that's not going to be enough to quell the streets unrest. I mean, in Tunisia, that's basically what it's something a lot bigger happened with the prime minister taking over control of the government, and even that wasn't enough, and the street was very courageously keeping the demonstration alive for a week until they finally announced the ministers were not going to be from the previous administration.
Yeah, I think Mubarak might have a chance if he dissolves the parliament and decides new elections.
Okay.
Hasn't he already dismissed the government?
I want to go to Omri in a minute, because I'm sure that Israel has been following all of this with a very, very close eye. But first, Charles, you wanted to say something.
I think it's no secret that any international relations, the hallmark is stability, to make things work and make things work well. So there's no surprise that international governments are taking the wait and see approach. I'm quite interested in the idea that these are leaderless movements, because that's got to scare a lot of governments, I think, about precisely what's going to come afterwards. Contrasted with what happened in Eastern Europe towards the end of the 90s, where there were, in fact, defined leaders and there were viable oppositions whose allegiances internationally were known. This is a very different set of circumstances, and I don't think it's any surprise whatsoever that you're getting a little bit of fence-sitting from a lot of international governments on how it's going to play out.
Yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned what happened in the Eastern Bloc 20 years ago, because that is exactly what it felt like when I was watching the revolts happening in... I don't know who's making noise. I think Omri's wife maybe is walking around. There's something happening in Israel. Someone's hungry for chips, apparently.
Or something. No, Sun chips.
It's in Berkeley, it's not in Israel.
I'm sorry?
Yeah. It's in Berkeley, not in Israel. We're staying here for a while.
So, yeah.
I told her.
Thanks. Very sorry, Mrs. Omri. So yes, let's get into that aspect of things. Obviously, so as you were saying, you're not in Israel at the moment, but as an Israeli national, you've been following all of this very, very closely, I'm sure. I really want to ask specifically, how did you look at it when it was just Tunisia, and how did it shift, if at all, when it started spreading to Egypt very seriously?
Well, it depends. Me as a Israel, as just a free loving, you know, person, I would love all the dictatorship around us to fall. If it's Syria or Jordan or Saudi Arabia, sorry, Turkey, but all of them, you know, all the tyrant and all the dictator, if they all fall down, I'll be happy. But Israeli, and I think we think that, well, Mubarak is a devil we know. Nobody likes him, so it's, you know, too much. But people trust him, and there were peace with Egypt for a long time now. And we're really afraid, you know, I think Israeli, at least the official Israel, is afraid of what will happen next. If it will be like Iran, when they depose a despot, and then we got the, you know, the Ayatollah, you know. So I think that's the main fear we have, that the Muslim Brotherhood will come as a winner, and the Egyptian people, instead of voting, you know, having a revolution for freedom, will have a revolution for Islamic radicals, and that won't be good. So,
is that,
that's the main fear.
Is that a, how do you, I'm going to, you know, really go to the other extreme here. What's the view on this in Saudi Arabia? You know, what's the relationship between between Saudis in general and the ideas of the Muslim Brotherhood?
The Muslim Brotherhood has, I think their ideology did affect Saudi Arabia in the days of Abdel Nasser. However, their ideologies are not even accepted anymore in Saudi Arabia. So, however, but considering they are, comes down to how will they work with the Saudi government. So it really, there's no exact situation where whether Saudis would approve or disapprove that. It does come down to how they will work with the Saudi government. Of course, Egypt is one of the Saudi Arabia's closest allies. And let's say Saudi Arabia owns a lot to Egypt, because most of how Saudi Arabia developed, Egypt is one of the oldest, most developed cultures in the Middle East, and it has influenced a lot of countries that came to develop under the Egyptian mentality of government, bureaucracy, and so on, and education.
Okay, Omri, I'm sorry, but we're getting a lot of noise from your back of your
kitchen. Sorry. So I'll disconnect. Thank you for letting me talk.
No worries. Thanks a lot. Sorry, Omri.
Bye-bye, no problem.
That was kind of funny. So for those who don't know, Omri has been on the show before, and he was very kindly offering his help in giving us the reaction of Israel in this matter, which it is very important, as we were saying, because all of this, the whole of, as you were saying, Scott, if there wasn't this worry about what was going to happen with the Muslim Brotherhood and, you know, Muslim radicals in general, then it wouldn't even be an issue, and maybe people would have come out more openly in favor of the revolutions. But as much, basically what I'm trying to say is, I think it's a little bit easy to condemn the governments for not coming out clearly in favor of this or that at this point. And even though, like Omri was saying, we would love to have everyone free in the whole world, even though we do want this, I mean, I'm speaking for myself, maybe you guys just want people to be enslaved forever. I don't know, can't speak for you. maybe, you know, there is this worry, very, very present, of what's going to happen next.
Well, yeah, and the government's not going to, I mean, no government, I don't think it's responsible for a government to come out and make a really strong statement one direction or the other when you're talking about a potential domino effect through that entire region. If Tunisia falls and the Egyptians go, woo, we're going to do this too. I mean, I'm oversimplifying, but they do it. And then who's to say the next one isn't going to do it? And they all start to fall. That is not a stabilizing influence. And, you know, we make a really good point. I can't remember who said it now, but the whole point of a leaderless opposition is kind of the way of the way things go in the Middle East. It seems like there's this, it's unpredictable, it's non-traditional, it's stuff that happens that doesn't have leaders, doesn't have a clear way to say, all right, well, this is what will be in place if this other thing falls. And so with all of that unknown, you can't take a side like that and be and dig your heels in, because you don't even know what you're supporting yet.
I don't really think it's a Middle Eastern thing, that it's the leaderless revolution. It's just that at this time, with these countries, leaders were systematically jailed or basically destroyed. So the only way anything could happen was that it was a real people's movement, and maybe not in a small part, the social networks made that possible.
Yeah, but when it comes to Egypt, I don't call what's going on in Egypt a leaderless movement. There's at least three different leaders that are leading this movement.
They are heads that are speaking for the movement, but I wouldn't say that they are leading it. The movement came from the street, don't you think?
No. It was called out, and one of the people who called out for it was El Baradei.
He arrived when it was already happening. He arrived, but
he did promote it before he arrived.
Well, yeah, of course. Everyone
was
saying, yeah, let's
do it. He was one of the people who was pushing for it. We can say that the Muslim Brotherhood did arrive late. However, they are the ones who brought it to the next level.
Right. So who's your leader then? The first guy or the second? See, that's my point, is there's no clear leader. It's a bunch of people vying for leadership, which means you're going to have internal fighting there. And there, nobody knows who should be in charge. There's no, I'm not even saying it needs to boil down to one dude or anything. I'm just saying, saying that there's three potential leaders just means there's three potential civil wars ready to happen. In my mind.
Yeah, and Turkey, just, I don't know whether you know or not, but how homogenous is Egyptian society? So are we likely to see a number of ethnic or religious or whatever it happens to be groups effectively in consistent opposition without a dictatorship leadership?
Oh, well, yeah, there might be between the Muslims and the Copts, but that would be a very minor opposition since the huge difference of population. And that's when I say Baradei is the most popular person to even lead the country, even for a temporary time until they get everything up and running. And he is supported even by the Muslim Brotherhood, even though his views are not very popular by the Muslim Brotherhood. But they would also allow them to come up out of hiding and be active in the political system.
Just so people know, Mohammed El Baradei was—he's a Nobel Peace Prize—and he's very much integrated in the Western world. He was the general director of the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency. So he is, in my opinion, I might be mistaken, but very far away from what the Western world is fearing would emerge as leaders of the of these countries. But that's,
well, I don't think anyone fears him. I don't think anyone fears
exactly.
him.
What,
That'd be,
what
that would be great.
About is, yeah, what we're worried about. And answering the question you were asking, Charles, it wouldn't be ethnic fighting, but we're worried that the educated parts of the country, which are probably, from what I understand, less in Egypt than they are in Tunisia, the educated would fall to maybe less educated people who would turn to the Muslim Brotherhood. Is that a fair assessment, Turkey?
Now tell me what you're saying about democracy earlier, Patrick, if that's a fear.
Well,
I'm sorry, come again? Charles, I didn't understand.
Just an observation that if the educated few have some sort of divine right over the more populous, uneducated amount, what does that say about your ideal for democracy?
We would have to talk quite a little bit about my ideas of democracy. You might be surprised.
just as a for information, the official word from Obama yesterday in a press conference, this is what he said. He said, "The United States will continue to stand up for the rights of the Egyptian people and work with their government in pursuit of a future that is more just, more free, and more hopeful." So very neutral, very supportive of both. And I think that's all you're going to see until something clear can happen that you either can get behind or oppose. And I think that's as good as a diplomatic statement as you're going to get, I think, moving into this thing.
It's a very clever piece of writing.
Yeah, it is.
Well, so, Patrick, get the are we not for. Live anymore?
Turkey?
Are we not live anymore?
We're coming back. I messed up the thing.
Okay, people are getting their torches and pitchforks.
So what were you saying?
Oh yeah, when Baradei is going to be he's the most likely person to leave the country as a transactional government if it ever happens. Definitely, the Muslim Brotherhood will own a majority in any government, in any parliament, in Egypt, if there is any free elections. There's no question about that. However, you really need to look into the Muslim Brotherhood.
Oh, Turkey. You're way too close to your mic.
Hello?
You're way too close to your mic. We're here.
That was awesome. It just got louder and louder. I love that.
I'm using my headset and just moved to... Is this better?
Yes. Thank you.
So, as I was saying, the Muslim Brotherhood definitely is going to get a majority in the government, in parliament, if there's any chances of free elections. However, the Muslim Brotherhood has evolved throughout time, and you do have the Muslim Brotherhood, if they actually are active in politics and are allowed to be legal, they're definitely going to be divided into different divisions. There won't be a single Muslim Brotherhood anymore. Because the views have diverse. You have those extremists who are still there in the Muslim Brotherhood. You got those who have turned into moderate. And you have those who believe in democracy and not Islamic government, but Islamic rights. So you have this division within the Muslim Brotherhoods. However, since they are not allowed to establish themselves as an independent party in Egypt, they are still united.
So you think the divisions will make it less, will make the Muslim Brotherhood as a whole not as powerful as some might?
Not as powerful from the point of view of extremism.
Oh, yes, of course, yeah. Okay.
Hey, just speaking of social like networks and the role that Twitter and the internet generally played here, Obama was asked about that. He said he called for Egypt to restore the internet, cell phone, and social media service, but at the same time, those protesting in the streets have a responsibility to express themselves peacefully. So again, call out the government, don't turn off the internet, this is authoritarian, that's stupid, bad idea, but all you people in the streets, quit throwing fire bottles at police, quit killing each other, quit whatever you're doing.
Yeah.
I mean, what else can you say? I mean, people are critical of that. I don't know what else you say. And I'm not a shill for Obama or anything. I'm just saying, what else would you do? Fly in there with bombs and, you know, napalm people? No.
No, but again, so that I become the contrarian here, you could say we fully support the Egyptian people and hope that the revolution goes as, you know, their movement goes as with as little violence as possible, but we think it's a great thing they're rebelling against dictatorship. That's definitely something both Obama and Sarkozy in France could say, and people everywhere around the world.
Yeah,
to a point, but
it's Charles. Would you agree? It's more like Yeah, it's kind of an issue of rhetoric versus calm discussion. You know, like words mean a lot, and if you because basically, Patrick, what you just said is what he said, but you're just using harsher terms. And I feel like that's all they've done is the difference is, well, how hard are our words? Are they going to be softer words that mean the same thing or harder ones that add, this flaming edge to them that we don't really need in a crisis? I don't know. That's arguable.
I don't really think that's what he said. I think what he said was very different. He said he was trying to, you know, be mellow enough sitting on the fence to have both parties be happy. Parties, I mean the revolution and the government. And in, he was trying to be diplomatic, which is, of course, something very admirable. But, you know, not admirable, but necessary.
Yeah.
But,
No, I agree. Charles, I agree with that.
Charles, you were saying something?
So the difference between what Obama said and the comment that you made just then, Patrick, is that Obama's fence sitting is about the outcome. And the type of rhetoric that you used in support of the people movement is completely sort of agnostic of any outcome. Guys, do whatever you want to do and we'll deal with what happens afterwards. And I don't think it's at all unreasonable for a government to be concerned about the outcome and the situation left afterwards and therefore make a statement like Obama made.
I'm not sure that's the case. I think the way I was saying it was great if the outcome is the revolution wins and crappy if the government stays in power. But it's hopeful. It's choosing a side. So if your side loses, then you're, you know, in bad shape. But if your side doesn't lose, then you're happy.
Yeah. I just think the world wins. Yeah.
Mm.
I just think in a world we're better off living in a world where a measured approach is taken in a time where we just need everything right now, bam, 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 and it's rash decisions and emotional reactions. I like that occasionally someone takes a measured approach to something and says, all right, everyone calm down for a second. We'll figure out a way to get out of this elevator when we're all trapped in it. It's that kind of thing. You want that voice. And I don't know. I'm not saying Obama's that voice. I don't know if the French government's that voice. I don't know who is. But I want more of that and less vitriolic gut reaction rhetoric from people.
I understand absolutely what you're saying. I think that the people, you know, walking in the streets and doing sittings and fighting tanks in Egypt right now wouldn't mind having someone, you know, come out for them in a very clear way. But I'm just being, you know, contrarian here. I completely understand why governments are not doing that. And I think it's a very easy shot at those governments to say, you can't even say that you like democracy enough to support the revolution. Yes, that's true.
Don't suppose anyone remembers what the government responses were to Tiananmen Square.
I don't remember, but that is a very good analogy. Although, you know,
I have no idea either.
We were very clearly against China at that point. I think at that point it was sort of easier to come out against the government in China during these events. Now, if the same thing happened, I'm pretty sure that given the economic, you know, intertwined economy that we have with China, I'm fairly sure that our governments would be, well, you know, we hope China.
You know what? I kind of disagree with that. I think that's an interesting opinion.
Well,
but
wrong.
I disagree because that is actually one of the powers of having a relationship with another nation where you have trade ties and stuff like that, is you can be open about criticism, but not worry about all the unknown factors. They're a known quantity. You kind of know where they stand. They're a traditional government. So are we. In this case, we're dealing with a possible overthrow and bunch of splinter groups, and nobody knows what's what, and who knows who's who, and there's a lot of unknown factors that I don't think they're comparable. The Tiananmen Square thing was easy to complain about, and
Scott,
the thing.
How cute. You think that if something like that happened, then Barack Obama would get up and say, bad China, you should let democracy arise.
No, it happens all the time. It happens all the time with China. China does something stupid, and we say something about it. And we do something stupid, and they say something about it. That is
a healthy exchange.
That's a healthy exchange between two established nations, I think.
Yeah, I definitely agree with Scott. There's just too much trade between these two countries. They need each other. So they can curse each other as much as they want, but they won't cut ties. Because if any of them cuts the other, they're going to hurt each other badly.
Well, I think wasn't there a whole hubbub when Hu Jintao went to the U.S. a couple of weeks ago or months ago? And because human rights were not mentioned once in anything anywhere?
I don't remember. The biggest stink that made was Rush Limbaugh was making fun of his accent and that he couldn't understand him, and that was a big deal.
Well, let's not even mention that guy.
You're right. It's a good point, though.
Yeah. Okay. I think we've spoken quite a bit about this whole thing. We've been a little bit, as I was saying, all over the place. Maybe not very clear in our rhetoric, but that's
well.
That's
I want to add, Patrick, yes? that there is an uprising in Yemen. There
yes,
are
absolutely
is an uprising in Jordan as well, and Syria.
We haven't heard as much about Jordan. We've heard that
Jordan is because Jordan is not against the monarchy or the establishment. The constitution is more against the government. Or the prime minister. So it's kind of less harsh. So it's not as bad as in the other countries where they want to overthrow the leader. So that's the difference. You have Syria that blocked everything related to the demonstrations in Egypt because they're worried. They cut off Facebook, Twitter, everything. And making sure that there's nobody. And there is a call for demonstrations in Syria, I think, next week. So let's see if it happens or not.
It is surprisingly reminiscent of what happened in the Eastern Bloc, as you were saying, Charlie, earlier. It's definitely, I very clearly remember feeling sort of that way 20 years ago, a little bit over 20 years ago, and thinking, holy crap, this is history happening before my eyes. And it was strange that, you know, unlike movies or history books or all of that, you could feel you can always feel the magnitude of these events, but it's normal that you're outside of them because, you know, they're in the past and you don't have a time-traveling machine. But in these occurrences, you still feel a little bit outside, but it's very strange that, you know, these things are happening as we speak. And then, you know, I turn off the TV and I go buy a loaf of bread. Or I go to work, or I watch a TV show. It's sort of a weird. At least it makes me feel very weird. And last time that happened was around 1990. Is there a chance that this is going to turn into as the fall of the Eastern Bloc, the fall of Middle Eastern democracies? I mean, obviously we don't have the answer, but. Any comments on this?
Well, if the uprisings are truly motivated by a desire on the core of the people's desire to do something to have a true democracy and get out
of I don't think that's in question. The question is it going to spread and happen everywhere?
Well, that's what I'm getting at is if that is the motivation and that's where they're headed with it. I suppose it's possible, but the big hitch for me is still, you can have an uprising, but if you don't have a plan, then what do you do? You know, it's one thing to say, we want more freedoms. This guy's been here too long. 30 years is too long. We want more freedoms. We want to be free to be Muslims, but we also want to be free to be, you know, multi-ethnic, you know, multicultural society. Okay, the fires have burned out. Everything's good. Everyone's kicked out. Now what? And that's why I don't know what that is.
Yeah. I don't. Yeah, I think their worry is not we want to be free to be multicultural. They just want to be free to not be hit over the head when they say something the government doesn't like. And I guess what I'm trying to say is they're not necessarily thinking that far ahead. You know, when a revolution happens, is, you know.
That's that's kind of my hitch with the whole thing is nobody's got the foresight right now, and it's not even their fault. Revolutions aren't necessarily well planned. Okay, on Tuesday we're going to rise up, and then on Thursday, you know, they don't think that way. I'm not even saying they should naturally have a plan. I'm just saying this feels very chaotic and not planned at all.
I think you should establish a Google document, a spreadsheet with a plan for the revolution, and share it with, you know, share with at Tunisia and at Egypt. You guys add your bits, and we'll have a plan at the end of this.
All right, let me see. The last time we tried that, Patrick, it didn't even work for the podcast. You think it's going to work for a revolution?
Damn it! Let's come out with something else then. Feeling that I was mentioning. Am I the only one that feeling weird about all this? Or,
by the way, I needed to ask you something. So, yes. 20 years ago, you were old enough to know that history is happening in front of you.
Yes.
All right.
Anything? Yes. Any subsequent comment about this? Bring it on.
No, I'm backing out.
Good. Excellent. Charles, you seem like an old fart too. comments about this?
Well, I had an excuse 20 years ago because that was round about the time that I was at university and getting a little bit interested in history around the Eastern European and communist situation there, because, hell, I was a student. What was I going to do? So I claimed that it was a semi-professional interest at that stage that I knew that history was happening. As far as your comments around feeling somewhat removed from it goes, I think it's a really interesting observation, but it's exciting all the same. One of the things that occurs to me, though, is that my excitement, my interest in this is kind of contrasted by the fact that people's lives are at stake. I saw a guy on a news clip turn to the camera and show his full face on the camera, and he said something along the lines of, you know, we're here to overthrow the dictatorship, down with the dictatorship. And the thing that occurred to me after I saw that and he ran off into the crowd was, good God, I hope they're successful, because if they're not, he's in a fair bit of strife. And that was something that kind of brought home to me that these are real people and real people's lives that we're dealing with, and we're just looking on. You're right. It's a really interesting dynamic to be involved in.
Well, yeah, that's why I meant when I said, you know, and then I go out and buy a loaf of bread. It's like I go back to these, you know, very mundane things while people are fighting for their freedom, you know, and some of them may be dying at the same time. And we're, yeah. I mean, people are dying all the time, but I don't know. It seems pretty obvious that this is a little bit different. Turkey, any parting thoughts with this topic?
Yeah, I just want to ask Charles. Apparently universities in Australia are different. I thought they just drink and party in date all the time.
Yeah, there is a fair bit of that. I could actually tell you what happened to my university career. Suffice to say that it didn't finish, and there may have been a bit of drinking and partying and things that may have contributed to that.
Well, it is an old prison colony after all. So,
all right, very interesting topic. We could be talking about this forever. Let's move on, though, to something else. As I was saying at the start of the show, there was really one giant, huge topic, which was this, and not a lot else. I mean, we could talk about the terrorist attack in Russia. We could talk about, I don't know, the State of the Union address, or, you know, Nelson Mandela getting sick. That these were some of the topics that came out. Any particular? We've already spent an hour on this. Any particular thing that came out as really important aside from the revolts.
Well, just to speak real quick to the State of the Union address, I just find it kind of ironic that his speech was focused almost entirely on domestic issues, which a lot of people really wanted. It was focused on economy, it was focused on jobs and you know, future tech and stuff we'd invest in, and you know, very, very here we are in the U.S., let's talk about us kind of, you know, talk. And
is that the way you felt, or the way the commentators told?
Oh, it's the way. I mean, it's what he said. I mean, there's no. I mean, there wasn't any. There wasn't. I mean, obviously, there's always talk about allies and stuff like that. But that hour and 1 minute speech he gave was. I listened to the whole thing twice. It was completely focused on domestic issues. And which is fine. That's, I mean, occasionally that's what a State of the Union does, and that is the State of the Union. But it's just ironic that a week later we have one of the, you know, the biggest international dust ups in the Middle East that we've had in a very long time, and maybe one of the biggest challenges diplomatically to his presidency, right after a speech that was clearly pointed inward. I just thought that was kind of interesting, but. And other than that, I mean, there's not much of note. It's all very, like I said, it's a lot of domestic stuff, but I just think it's ironic that right after that speech, we launch into, you know, one of the world's, I think one of the most interesting things that'll happen this year, worldwide. So anyway,
we obviously did hear about the, you know, State of the Union address in France too, which is interesting to think that, you know, we hear about your basically what is a internal speech, and we're like, yeah, of course we know about it in France. I'm sure when our president says something, you're like, he what? The when?
Well, it depends. It depends on what he says. Like everyone everyone hears when, you know, Bush got up and called out the axis of evil stuff. And so that of course had a huge impact on other countries and cause all kinds of issues, but it's not always like that. It's oftentimes just sort of about us and what's going on with, you know, are we investing in mass transit? Are we behind in the race to get better broadband? All that kind of stuff.
That's what I mean. When you have your State of the Union address, every time it makes the news in France. I guess it makes the news in Australia and Saudi Arabia too.
That's because we're America, damn
it. It makes the news. It's not a headline.
yeah. No, it's not a headline. But all right, let's move on to another headline, which is the floods. What the hell is happening down under?
Oh, yeah, dude. Crazy.
Oh, it rained. It rained.
All right, let's move on to something else.
I was trying to get some hard data on the scale of this stuff, and it shows you my dedication that I didn't actually come up with any, because it's probably really easy to find. I had a quick look on the net for 5 minutes, couldn't be bothered, and then thought I'll just talk about it instead.
That's fine. That's the way we usually do the show anyway, so no worries.
I did hear an earlier report talking about the scale of the floods and saying that that it was roughly the size of Victoria, one of the southern states, which puts the flooded area at almost the size of the UK, if not a little bit bigger. So that gives you an indication as to how big it is. Scott, I think you're probably you understand space where you are, right? Australia is quite large. Sure.
Big old chunk of land for sure.
Yeah, the river systems in that part of Queensland are quite complex. When they floods join river systems join, and the flooded areas get absolutely huge. What's a little bit different this time is that the impact that it's had on town centres. Some of which have been absolutely devastating, including the capital of the state of Queensland, which is Brisbane. The main river in Brisbane, the Brisbane River, flooded. So we're talking about a CBD that got flooded. Not all of it, of course, but part of it. So it's not rural. It's not it's not removed. It's you know, people that I work with couldn't turn up to work on the day because their buildings were flooded in a CBD. It's really quite bizarre. But the public debate, if you like, has now arisen around how we respond to it.
Oh, but the federal Before you get into that, what's the situation now as we're speaking? Is it resolved? Is it still raining?
The situation is that the floodwaters, certainly in Queensland, are subsiding or have subsided. Down my end of the world, down in Victoria, there's a fairly large-ish river system up towards the north of Victoria around the Murray. That's that and some associated rivers are in flood, and there's a very large mass of water which is continuing to move. So towns, if you like, along the path of the flood are just waiting for the flood waters to peak and come by them and subside. It's a fairly slow-moving mass of water, and it will, I believe, from what I understand, will continue to cause troubles for some weeks yet.
I see. Okay, because I have to say, once things started happening in Tunisia, then we had a couple of more mentions of the floods in Australia, and that was it. But it is, like, the biggest natural disaster in the country's history, right?
About 2 years ago, there were some bushfires in Victoria. You may or may not remember them being reported, yes. But about 120-odd people were killed in fires in and around areas around Melbourne. In terms of cost...
Yeah, this time it feels like towns were completely flooded, destroyed, yeah. Basically. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, smaller towns were entirely destroyed by the fires as well. But in terms of cost to the economy, this one dwarfs it. It's hit agricultural areas. It's hit the mining industry. It's obviously, as I said, hit the CBD. Hundreds, if not thousands, of houses are inundated and need to be repaired. So the shift now comes to what the cost of this is. It's been costed at the moment that it's about $6.2 billion was the last I heard, damage to the economy. And as I say, now the public debate has shifted towards how do we pay for it? The federal government is intends to put in place a flood tax for 12 months to tax people to raise money for the rebuilding efforts. And so the debate is now, should we be taxed for this? Or should the government reduce spending elsewhere to pay for it? I'm personally quite surprised by the vehemence with which some people are saying, no, we don't want to pay a tax. If we want to give to the flood relief efforts, let us do it off our own bat rather than the government taxing us. It surprises and, to be honest, disappoints me a little that that's the position of so many people in the country, because that seems to be where the public opinion lies.
How did people react to, the costs incurred by Katrina in the U.S. a few years ago? Well, I'm sure there wasn't talks of any kind of tax, which is a socialist economic tool, of course. But
there wasn't any kind of how do I put this? I mean, I have family directly affected by that flood. We had Kim's aunt lived with us for about 8 months because her house was basically underwater. So, I mean, we had all kinds of sort of direct effects from that thing. And the biggest problem we had is the complaint that Bush's administration and the emergency services at the time were not up to snuff. They weren't ready. So all the taxes we already spend for that were not being used effectively. So that was more of the issue. It wasn't that because certainly we have the infrastructure and money and tax system, even in that Republican administration, to cover such things. The problem was that we were horribly inefficient at doing that. We hadn't had a disaster of that scale, and response time was terrible. And so the biggest problem was, it wasn't so much that, yes, this is a shared responsibility and money should go into it. It was the money that we have already put into it was being horribly misappropriated because we were inept at using it. And that was the big problem there.
I see.
Yeah.
Turkey, how do you guys even see this thing that is almost out of the understandable, which is so much water falling down that you can't even walk
you
in
think
the streets?
So? You think so?
Well, that's right. I remember you were...
Just sank.
The what?
Jeddah City was flooded just three days ago.
I remember you sent a few pictures on Twitter with an actual, like, serious flood. You couldn't get to where you wanted to go.
That was in Riyadh, and that wasn't serious flood. Jeddah City has been flooded Wednesday, and it's in a very bad
state. Really? You had a cigar thing to go to, and you were late. Is that the deal?
So you mean it's worse than the one that happened in Riyadh what was it, like 2 weeks ago?
Yeah, it's 10 times, 100 times worse.
Jesus.
Jeddah City has a very horrible infrastructure, and it's there's hardly any sewage system, and it's in low...
Well, you don't usually need it, right?
No, every city has it. It's just there is... Jeddah has a problem of poor planning and corruption, which resulted in a very poor infrastructure. And when it rained heavily last week, the entire city sank. There were 10 dead until now reported. They had to rescue about 5,000 people.
Wow.
And the people had stuck in their offices. They had to spend the night at their offices because they couldn't leave the office and go home. Students were stuck in the university. They ended up sleeping in their classes because they couldn't leave thanks to all the rain, because the roads were completely sunken. And if you ever are interested, you can look on Twitter for the hashtag Jeddah Rain, and you'll see a lot of people posting a lot of pictures.
Interesting. Well, I take it back then. you can be flooded. So I guess you. But we did get a few mentions of that. Did you guys hear about it at all? Or, you know, I'm sorry, I meant the Australian floods.
We heard about it. I don't know if it was big news or not, but we heard about it. And to be honest, I'm not exactly the right person to say whether everybody heard about it. I don't think it was covered much in local newspapers as far as I read.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, with everything happening so much closer to home. But so I guess my next question is, I think it's the first time we have an Australian living in Australia on the show. Kerwin was here a few times, but he lives in Europe, so it doesn't count. Well, you know, he's in the UK.
We export a lot. Kerwin included.
That's the way you said it. It's funny. Like, he's not a real Australian. He's in Europe now.
You know, we joke saying, you know, it's the land down under. It's far away. You're in summer, and it's the middle of the night for you. All of that. We feel basically that Australia is very remote. It's out of our field of understanding almost. And when the floods happen, it's horrible, but it's like, it's so far away, it stays as external news to us, very much so. Do you guys feel like you're part of the Western world, like physically? Or do you feel like also like we're this whole other continent, and we have to deal with our stuff? Just out of curiosity.
That's probably a very, very long question to answer. I think Australia feels its remoteness itself. To go anywhere takes quite a bit of effort, actually, even within Australia. The geography of the country is such that we've got, what, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 odd major centres, maybe 7, depending on how I want to count them. And the closest separated by something like 600 kilometres, what does that make it, 400 miles or so. So the distances and the remoteness even within the country is something that we overcome. Things that happen in Queensland are literally 2 days' drive from where I am here. Something that would happen in Perth would be 3 days' drive from where I am here. So it's a big place, not only remote from other places, but remote from itself to an extent. your problems and what you deal with yourselves. One of the things, I guess, being a westernized country is we get a lot of popular culture from the United States. We're a penal colony. Thanks for pointing that out, Scott. So we've still got very strong ties with the United Kingdom. And things that happen in both Great Britain and the United States tend to be reported on quite heavily here. Things that happen in Africa, things that happen in the Middle East, things that happen, I'm sorry, Patrick, in France, probably a little bit less so. We are very much aligned with our traditional parents being the United Kingdom and our new fun dad being the United States.
Mm. I see.
Yeah, I guess, you know, that's fair. That's fair. All right, that was sort of an outside of the general conversation question, but thank you very much for answering candidly. Let's move on to, you know what, I want to talk about something else, and I'm very curious to know if you've heard about it and how much. I'm going to make my sort of local story into something that is not directly French, but I'm going to display a lot of kinship with our Belgian friends by talking about the
you hesitated, you know, that was funny.
I was going to say brothers, but I felt, you know, they're Belgians. I don't want to go that far. But, yeah, so
the French-speaking ones might be brothers. The Flemish-speaking ones, we just don't talk about them, do we?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's like, they're, you know, there's still a bunch of them, which is the exact issue here. So in case you haven't heard, basically Belgium is breaking apart because the do you say Flamen or, you know, the Dutch-speaking part wants to break? Well, okay, that's not quite accurate. Some parts of the country want to divide it into two different very autonomous entities between the French and Dutch-speaking parts. And there's also some German thrown in there somewhere, I think. But basically, the government has been fighting for months and months. The king can't manage to get a prime minister to stay in place and get people to agree. People who want to separate the country or to divide it have so much power now and public support that we're not even sure that Belgium, as we know it, is going to perdure for very much longer. And we really don't know what's going to happen. And that's something that is very concerning and rare at the same time, because in Europe, we haven't had that much of internal, you know, countries being broken apart, except for Eastern Europe, which is a different story altogether, since, you know, World War II, probably. So this is obviously a huge amount of news coming out into France, which is being dwarfed by what happened in Tunisia and Egypt, but is definitely a concern for us and for the Belgian people also, of course. So my question is, did you guys hear about poor old little Belgium, or did you not?
This is news to me, but I got a solution for you. It's easy.
I'm scared.
So we're talking about leaderless revolutions and stuff. This is simple. Break it apart, or if you don't want it to be broken apart, you want it to stay unified, a simple phrase, President Jean-Claude Van Damme. And you're set. You're done. It'll solve all your problems. But no, I haven't heard a thing about this. This is totally news to me.
This is,
you know, that's actually a well-known political theory, Scott. That's called the California theory.
It's actually a pretty good point, but you know, I nominate JCVD for your little problem there, but yeah, I haven't heard a thing about it. And there's all kinds of stuff on the web, obviously, but just hasn't been a big news thing for us.
How about Australia?
Belgium, where's that?
Okay, fair enough. Turkey?
Well, actually, I heard something.
Well, you're geographically closer, so...
No, well, I don't remember where I heard about it, but I did hear about demonstrations in Belgium against the government not being established for, I think, what, 7 months now?
Yeah.
Yeah, something like that. I heard something about that, so...
Yeah, it's surprising that you haven't heard of it at all, because, like, literally, the country is falling apart. It's a very, very serious thing that they're in now, but... All right, that was just a little show of compassion and brotherhood with my Belgian friends. How about Turkey? Do you have something you want to add to the show in the news department?
Nothing that comes to mind.
Nothing happened in Saudi Arabia that was worth mentioning?
Was something happening to me worth mentioning?
Something happening to you is worth mentioning anyway, even without relations to Saudi Arabia.
In Saudi Arabia, there's not much going on other than flooding.
Okay, that's already something.
Yeah, so that's the biggest news right now.
Okay. We've covered that already, I guess.
All right.
Scott?
Yes. Oh.
Scott, what about your little piece of good old US of A?
Well, I could talk about the continued investigation into the shooting in Tucson and all the political upheaval that caused and all that other stuff, but
instead, you're going to choose not to.
I'm going to talk about just briefly a story that happened just 20 miles from me. A dude ran over a neighbor's dog and killed it because it pooped on his lawn. And that's how far we've come as a society. So anyway, so that's my story for that. And then all the news right now is Charlie Sheen.
Did it become news?
Well, it's not really. It's news to us, but it's not news outside of like my little community here.
Okay.
But all anyone's talking today about is freaking Charlie Sheen and his stupid, porn party that went 36 hours and they had to pump his stomach and he's in rehab now and all that stuff's so freaking stupid. I hate it.
Wait,
so,
didn't actually hear of this. A porn party that went on for 36 hours?
36 hours straight. He started complaining of stomach pains. They rushed him to the hospital.
I don't have a lot of respect for that guy anyway, but... I mean, now 36 hours, that guy can go. That's impressive.
Yeah.
Now you have respect for him?
Well, I don't know. Let's say I'm impressed.
He's a douche. He's a complete douche, and so that kind of stuff's big in the news right now. But yeah, I'm happy to just share my little local story of some guy who I think I've seen before, by the way, run over this dog because he was mad about that. Pretty stupid.
Well, first you deal with it's serial killers. First you do that to little animals, and then you run over people.
Yeah, it's a gateway drug. Keep it. Exactly. Yeah.
You know what really pissed me off this month? I was watching Twitter, and I don't know if you remember that that video of that lady that was watching her phone. She was texting, and she was walking in the mall.
And
she didn't see a fountain or something?
Fountain,
she fell in the water. And so that was funny, video of people walking and falling down. That's always funny, and that's, what the internet is for, except for porn. And so that was fine. And then someone tweeted, I think it was, I can't remember how I got to it, but basically there was a video of CNN doing a follow-up story on that story, because the lady was saying that she wanted to sue the people who were watching on the camera for whatever reason. And that was on CNN. And I understand that, CNN isn't news, hasn't been news for a long time. But for some reason, seeing this infuriated me more than everything else I've seen on CNN in the past few years. It was really a sort of a catalyst of this is what CNN has come to, you actually do not only the video itself of the funny lady falling down, but you report as news the follow-up to that story because she's angry and she wants to sue.
Dude, like, you know, I've told you on this show before, it's they have 24 hours to fill, and they run out of crap to talk about. They almost they get on the edge of almost making things up. It's ridiculous. 24-hour news networks are ridiculous. I hate it.
And plus, American loves to sue, so Americans have to.
Sure, but you know, there is still, I understand all this, and I know all this, and we've talked about it a lot, but it's still, at one point, you're like, where's CNN? CNN, that's a name that used to mean something a few years ago. And you're watching your lineup for the next half an hour, and you're like, all right, at hour, you know, minute 26, we're going to talk about the journalist presenting the thing, gets to that thing, and he's like, we're going to talk about a lady who fell down and got a video on the internet?
Yeah.
That's really the lineup that we're building on CNN?
Yeah.
And he could go, you know, let's talk about dictatorship came about in Egypt for an extra minute and a half.
Instead of talking about that. CNN thing. Did you watch it on in France?
It was on no, it was on the web. It was a clip cut off, you know, recorded off of CNN.
All right, that was for the US viewers. That's why.
But yeah, they don't, it's not like, well, I mean, let's be clear. It's not like they're starting their newscast with this story. It's a leftover piece of turd that they tack on to the end of things and try to make it, you know, a public, or what's the word for it? There's a word for this. But anyway, it's like in the old newsreels. If a dog could play ping pong, hot damn, you put it at the end of your newsreel. It's not like that's changed so much. The big difference is 24 hours to fill. You can only talk about shark attacks being up for so long before people need to hear something else. It's ridiculous. That whole system is broken. I hate it.
Yeah, I'm sure, you know, you're being reasonable here, and it's sort of, you know, killing my buzz, but it did, you know, it was more of a little thing that got me onto the whole process and got me angry for everything else. But anyway, I guess that is going to be it for the show, unless any of you guys has anything else.
Hang on, just one more thing. One more thing.
Oh, wait, he's going old Steve Jobs on us.
I mean, there was something that I looked at in the paper the other day, and to be honest, I didn't read the article. Scott, you mentioned you're from Utah, is that right?
Yeah, I live in Utah. Yep.
Okay, that's great. Because what's been reported in the papers here is that Utah is the first state to adopt an official gun.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about this stupid thing. It's not going to happen. somebody in the state Senate is trying to push for having that as their kind of logo for stuff. And no, it's no way it's going to pass. It's completely ridiculous.
Wait, what? Can you explain? I didn't understand.
And I've kind of, to be honest, I've kind of avoided it as well. But I'm going to find it here real quick. Gun logo. Okay, so the whole idea was... gun application. I can't find it now. Oh, here it is. The Utah legislation. So basically what this means is one guy in the legislation or legislators stood up and said, look, we're considering having a state gun. So every state has a state bird. We have a state, you know, flag, all the things you do in states. And they want to have an official gun. And so they're talking about this 100-year-old semi-automatic weapon that was used in the military in the Old West and stuff like that. And they want that to be this gun on you know, it'll appear on literature and be, you know, listed as our official gun. And it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. Mm. There's too much of opposition. See, people forget. So Utah's an extremely conservative state outside of Salt Lake City. Salt Lake City is fairly metropolitan. It's a beautiful city and has just it's culturally diverse and it's awesome. You get outside of that, it gets a little funky, and that's where this is coming from. It won't pass. It's not going to happen. It's a stupid idea. Freaking gun. Ugh.
No, I think I disagree. Actually, I think you should, you know, that would open up a whole bunch of different, you know, state things that you could get into.
Right.
You could get a state computer or a state phone or
state,
you know,
state toilet
car.
Paper brand. Exactly. Where do you stop? That's the problem with it. The only advantage
I
see
to
this
is a state tactical nuclear weapon.
That's a good idea. But maybe there's so many. See, our state bird is a seagull, which is not even our bird. We get it from California. So seagulls are our state bird. I think that maybe an official gun would lead people to shoot more seagulls. And that's probably good because they're trash birds and they're everywhere. Anyway.
Yeah, I was going to make fun for you having the state bird being a seagull. But our bird is, you know, a rooster, so it's not like we're especially proud. And
France has a, or is it Paris or the whole country?
No, the whole country. You know, the Fear. Germans have the eagle, like the proud and, you know, super impressive thing that flies over your head.
Yeah.
And we have the little annoying animal feather thing that runs around going like, and, you know, wakes you up when you want to sleep. And
that was a really good
impression. That's actually our.
Funnily enough, ours is the emu.
But see, at least yours is exotic. Ours is the California gull. It's not even our state's bird. It's like it came from somewhere else.
Well, you know, it's exotic for us, Scott. It's not exotic for them.
No, not
really. Oh, well, hang on. I just got to clear them out of the backyard this morning.
Yeah, exactly. For all I know, you know, they might think that the rooster is incredibly exotic, and they're like, ooh, the French are so lucky to have the rooster as their national bird.
Okay, I said we're isolated, not stupid.
Patrick, do you know how quick our national bird, the American eagle, the bald eagle would swoop down and eat your rooster like in a heartbeat?
I know. That is what I'm saying. Why did we choose the rooster? It has to do with, you know, probably because the French are just as annoying. I don't know. Do you have a national bird, Turkey? Or is that
the turkey?
National bird?
Yeah, that was kind of funny. Yes. Do you have a national bird, Turkey? Thank you, Scott, for pointing that out.
God, it's you're written, dead.
It's written with an I. It's completely different.
I don't think we have any national birds, okay, as far as I know. We have camels.
That would work.
A winged camel. There's your national bird.
A whammel. All right. It's good to laugh even when we talk about serious stuff like we do in this show. And I think the whammel is going to bring the show to an actual close. I want to thank the chat room that has stuck with us, even though the multi-video thing has pooped out midway through.
Hey, wait.
Ooh.
I want to make an announcement.
I'm sorry?
I want to make an announcement on your podcast.
Do you want to? Is it the announcement I'm thinking about?
Yes.
But I thought it was too early.
And there are live people listening. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You don't... Ooh, are you sure?
Yeah. I'm too excited, I have to say it.
Okay, no problem. So Turkey has an announcement to make, which he is very excited about, and we are very excited also. And thank you so much for doing it on the show. I'm honored.
He's pregnant, right? No.
Well, they do say sometimes I'm pregnant, but I think maybe if I exercise, I won't be anymore.
All right, go for it, man.
All right. So, announcement is I met this wonderful woman on my podcast, and everybody who ever heard the first relaunch of my podcast, her name is Manal, and we're engaged.
Oh, I'm so excited.
Yay. That's awesome.
Congratulations, man. I'm so excited.
Patrick's next. You know, that's true. Congratulations, well. Turkey. That's totally awesome, dude.
Thanks. Turkey, I'm extremely, extremely excited for you. First of all, because I'm sure you're going to be extremely happy. And second of all, because you're going to stop telling me that, you know, I'm so lucky that I have a girlfriend and that, you know, you never meet women. And now you're actually married. You one-upped me. I mean, you're not married yet, but you're engaged.
Yep, congratulations. I'm engaged. And if everything works out okay, I'm getting married in May.
In May? Jesus. Wow.
Yeah, don't wait.
Yeah, I don't play, dude.
That's incredible. I have to say, though, without revealing anything too much, I've met my girlfriend, I don't know, maybe a couple of a year and a half ago. And to be completely honest, I have, you know, no doubt I'm going to spend a very long time with her. And I realized that very quickly. It was completely different from what my previous relationships. So when you're, I imagine that, you know, when you're actually sure of something like that, it comes really quick and you don't need to wait for 10 years to know what happens.
Yeah. And the minute you find a girl, this is advice to anyone out there. We can learn from Patrick. Anytime you find a girl who does not mind a extremely hairy man who smells like cheese, get on that. Stay with her. Do not let her go.
Anyway. Yeah, I agree. I'm definitely not letting her go. Did you know immediately, Scott, that you were going to marry Kim?
I kind of did. Yeah. Yeah, weird. I mean, I'm not a big sappy fan of the whole. I knew it was love at first sight, but it kind of was. You know, you kind of knew. I don't like to admit it, but yeah, I kind of knew, and it was perfect.
Scott, this is what I tell Manal. I told her when I saw Titanic, I thought this is the most stupid movie ever. How can anybody fall in love so fast?
Yeah.
Now I can't say that anymore.
Wow. That serves you right. Excellent. All right. Well, the whole of the Phileas Club staff, which is basically me, wishes you, Turkey, a long and happy life with your bride-to-be.
Thanks a lot, Zeb.
And if you want to leave a message to Turkey, you can do that on the blog, which is available at thephileasclub.com. It will take you to the article of this episode. And please, please, please do go there and leave comments to tell us what you think of this tremendous event in the show's life. I'm very excited. All right, so I guess that's going to be it. Would you guys like to tell the listeners where they can find your other stuff? Turkey, I noticed that A Saudi Life has not been updated since you relaunched it. Are you going to be doing the shows monthly or?
Yeah, monthly. I already recorded this February show and should be out on the 1st of February.
Excellent. Where else can people find you?
Well, you can find me on the website, saudilife.net, or on Twitter, and my ID is at Saudi.
Excellent. Charles, I'm not sure. Do you have a website you want to promote? I know you have a Twitter account, which I horrendously misspelled a couple of hours earlier.
I have no online presence, and my Twitter account is mostly tedious, but if you're really committed, you can follow me at Extrepid, if you like. Yeah.
That's Extrepid, E-X-T-R-E-P-I-D, and not like the very 90s version, Extrepid, which I assume it was.
No, not like that, but I love your thinking.
Scott, a few people in the world might not know where to find you. Why don't you tell them?
Sure. They can find me. Primarily everything I'm up to is at frogpants.com. If they want to find something new happening, go check out the new morning show. It's the morning stream. Yeah, there's a pee joke in there. You can find that at frogpants.com/TMS. And they can always follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/extralife.
How's the morning stream going? I'm talking about the show.
Way better than I expected. I kind of went into it thinking it would be kind of... It was something I just have always wanted to do, so I knew I was going to have fun with it. But I didn't know what the reception would be. And I appear to have an unmitigated hit on my hands, and I don't quite know what to do with it. Our viewership in the morning is growing every morning. We capped out at 250 the other morning, which is a lot for a morning. Of live viewers, and then we had another 150 on a audio only stream that people could get on their phones and stuff. And then we have the podcast is, you know, in the 20,000 mark already, and it's going up Monday through Thursday every day. And
you're putting
crazy.
The whole it's 3 or 4 hours, right?
No, we're only doing it's an hour and a half is all, so it's 90 minutes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's actually shorter than this show, now that I think about it. but it's every Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. We take Friday off. It's me and Brian Ibbett in the booth, and we appear to be hitting a nerve. People like it, and we talk politics and crazy celebrity news and take phone calls live on the show, and it's a whole lot of fun. I'm really digging it.
Cool. I'll try to catch it.
We need to call in. We need to bring you in is what we need to prank call you is what we'll probably do at some point.
please do that. I'm usually at work when you do it, so it's sort of difficult for me to listen to it. But if you call, you know, I'm going to go like, hello, Patrick. This is Patrick.
Which would be great.
Yeah, that would be fun. All right. Yeah. I'll be looking forward to that very soon.
All right.
And if you want to hear more from me, just go to patrickbeja.com and find all my links on that site. And that is going to be it for us. We are going to be back in about a month. And by then, Turkey might have accelerated his wedding schedule and might actually be married and maybe even have a couple of children.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
Thanks a lot, everyone. We'll talk to you in a month. Bye.
Visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.